Babylon 5, at its core, is a five-year history, from this year to this year. But life continues in either direction. And the fans want to know what happened over here, and what happened over here. And if there were things that could be done without messing up this story, I thought, well, let's show that part of it.
In my world, there are books, thousands of pages, about the power of one mind to change the universe.
Got it. It's right here. Right here.
Do not thump the book of Shaquan. It is disrespectful.
This is still the Babylon Project podcast.
The year is 2020. The place, the Babylon Project podcast.
Well, hello there, Babylon 5 fans. This is Raul Wybera, and you are still listening to the Babylon Project podcast. Just because we finished the television materials doesn't mean that Babylon 5 ends yet for us. We have a whole lot of books to go through still, so you're still going to be hearing from us. And when I say us, this is, as I said, Raul, and I am joined, as always, by my good friends Jim Arrowood and J.P. Harvey. How are you two gentlemen tonight?
Fantastic.
Doing well.
And I'm sure lurking in the background, we have our erstwhile producer, Troy Rutter. Hello there, Troy. Yeah, I know. That's what I expected to hear in response. Oh. So we're going to start in on the books. Now, correct?
Yeah.
That is correct.
And it's a little, we're going to have to shift up the format just a bit, because how we approached the television series and how we approached the movies really isn't going to fit well into a book format. So, Jim, you did a wonderful job putting an outline together, too, I have to add.
Oh, well, thank you. Content subject to change depending on our needs.
It worked really well for me.
So we'll see how this works.
Once I got through hooked on phonics and could read the book, this was a fantastic outline.
For some of our folks who are listening who might be a little younger or may not have even been aware of the books, I've got to warn you in advance, some of these books can be a little bit difficult to find, but keep your eyes open on eBay as far as whether you want to find the books, or on Amazon as far, you know, if you can find them used. I will say this, the single hardest book to find, though, is going to be the third book of the Legions of Fire, the Centauri trilogy. I don't know why. It wasn't a huge run printed or something, but that will be your hardest to find.
All right. So what are we doing tonight?
Which book? We will be talking about, well, the what's called the numbered series, 1 through 8 or 1 through 9, depending on whether or not you consider, you know, how you consider To Dream in the City of Sorrows. We'll be treating that as number 9 rather than its complete standalone. But we will be doing the very first of those books. It's called Voices, and it was written by John Vornhult.
Mm-hmm. And so, JP, do you have any other information on this book that you did during your very extensive research?
A little bit. I don't know how extensive it is.
Oh, I see.
But there is a little data. I missed if Raul brought it up at the very beginning there, but this book was published by Dell in 1995. So it's as old as the original series. This is out of the numbered series. And if we want to talk canon or not canon, those original books in the numbered series kind of loosely fit into canon, or you could say in broad strokes, they're canon according to JMS, with the exception of 7 and 9. Those are solidly canon. JMS wrote the framework or the outline for these books, so he does lay claim to them and takes responsibility or ownership or whatever you want to call it.
Oh, now you're making me feel bad.
But this one, Voices, is not solidly canon. So it's a story in the universe. What was the quote in the intro? The story goes in different directions, or he hopes to take it in different directions without messing up the story, I hope. Some successes and failures in there, I guess. But that's this one. Here's a quote, actually, from JMS, and I'll use that to wrap it up. In broad strokes, yes, the series is canon, since I came up with the outline for all the Del Rey novels. And overall, I'm very pleased with how they've been going. So if the man himself embraces these, I think that's why we're reading them. They're worth the read. But we'll talk about what we think of them, obviously, just like we did with the TV shows.
Yeah. Like he says, in broad strokes, back in 2000, yeah. Today the phrase would be pseudo-canon, I think, for a lot of these books. Right. But 7 and 9 especially, I would agree. Those are absolutely solid, solid canon.
And one other little nugget, this book, for those who have read it, will know this, but the book, the story in the book takes place in 2258. And if you go back and look at the original series timeline, season 1 happens in 2258. But there are things in the book that will tell you that we must be at the tail end of that because Sheridan has already become the commander of the station.
Yeah, after Sheridan has come on board.
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So, just aside, I'm sorry about jumping ahead.
No worries.
I've got my notes open closer, and it did, so I don't know.
You know, and actually, in this case, it really is. For future books, we might go ahead and stay with how you had it originally, Jim. But especially since we're setting a basis here, the jump ahead is probably a smart thing to do anyway, because the whole canonicity discussion was most certainly a concern about the books, which ones are, which ones aren't. The trilogies, by the way, definitely are considered hard canon as well. The three trilogies. So, but that's all in the future.
Yeah. I'd like to throw in a little bit of a discussion on canon. maybe after, just a very little bit, right after the summary.
Okay.
Maybe.
Speaking of the summaries, why not give us one so we can get some context for this part of the discussion?
Archive access initiated.
Telepaths to the left of them, telepaths to the right of them, and danger is all around. Commander Susan Ivanova and Security Chief Michael Garibaldi when a Psi-Corps convention is held on Babylon 5. Someone will turn this meeting of mind readers into a real blast as a bomb makes Babylon 5 a death trap. Voices, the prime suspect is resident telepath Talia Winters, with Talia's old foes, thought cops Bester and Gray, calling for her head. Ivanova can't openly help her. Now she's running for her life through a perilous universe, and her psychic talent is her only weapon when her path is blocked by staggering intergalactic horrors. Psi-Corps is closing in, and a killer is waiting. And so, and then also on the inside, we get a note on the historical place for this book. The events in this novel take place shortly after the events depicted in the second year episode Points of Departure and prior to the events in A Race Through Dark Places.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
So there, yeah, there is that.
Right. And
so
I think you have a sound clip in support of this as well, Jim.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and listen to that.
Cool.
Babylon 5 at its core is a 5-year history from this year to this year, but life continues in either direction. And the fans want to know what happened over here. and what happened over here. And if there were things that could be done without messing up this story, I felt, well, let's show that part of it.
It's fun to really explore the characters further. You have to keep it true to what you've already seen on the television show. The fans know what Sinclair sounds like, or they know what Marcus Cole sounds like. They know how these characters speak. And when they read the book, they're going to hopefully hear the actors' voices saying that in their heads as they read.
The books were really designed, to some extent, to fill in the corners, to see what happened on Centauri Prime after Londo became emperor. For those who wanted to know what happened to Alfred Bester, we showed his fate in the Psycor trilogy.
You can do things in a book that you simply don't have the budget for on a TV show. So if I wanted space battles, I could have space battles. I wanted to see a lot of Minbars, look at the cities and things like that, I could do that. It was just as long as I check it with Joe, he gave me the freedom to do what I wanted to do.
So guys, I'm going to hijack the show for a minute, and I want to talk about canon.
Not the one that goes boom.
Personally, no,
there's
no.
There's always boom.
Yeah, there's always going to be boom, whether there's a canon or not. But no, C-A-N-O-N, canon. I often have to explain this to my students at school, because when I say canon to them, they think of a big gun, C-A-N-O-N.
Especially when you do the 1812 overture.
No, well, I don't do that one. They wouldn't understand it anyway. But I do have to explain to them about canon. I'm not going to go into how I do that, but I am going to say that whether a book is canon or not canon, I don't care.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Okay. If it's a good story, if I am entertained, if the characters, as was mentioned in that sound clip, the characters, I can hear their voice and they are true to the characters that I saw on the TV show, or if they follow along from one book to the next, in the case of something that isn't connected to a show, I don't care if it's canon. It just has to be good.
You know, Jim, in a lot of ways, I kind of agree with you. In fact, that's what eventually killed my enjoyment of the Star Wars expanded universe. I at first, when Lucas was keeping a really tight-fisted control over it, what you described and what Catherine described was really met, and then things got loosened up, and it's like, well, wait, that's not what he would do or what he would say, and it started to lose it for me. So I would certainly agree with that.
One of my students completely lost his mind when Disney bought Star Wars, and Disney said all of the books that have gone before are no longer canon. And the guy just about lost his mind, and I said, so what? You know,
right, as if those books disappear all of a sudden.
Yeah. I said, did you read all of the books? He says, oh yeah, I've read about 100 books, you know, whatever it is. And I said, did you enjoy them? Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I said, so what? What's the big deal?
I actually loved but it anyway. When Disney did that, just because it was a poke in the eye of, I'm not suggesting this was your student in any way, shape, or form, but we've both known some Star Wars basement-dwelling no-lifers.
oh, yeah.
And, the meltdown was, this is Raoul's evil side squeaking through here. The meltdown was somehow a pleasing sensation.
He's so mean.
Damn Skippy. Now, that said, based on what Catherine said here, and this will kind of segue us to the overall impressions, she's right on knowing what they sound like and on the plot, you know, and on the story being solid. And for me, that is where the book fails completely. I remember when the book first came out, being all excited about it, and I almost gave up on the book and was almost ready to it, it what took an effort for me to give book two a chance. And I remember why. The characters are very off, and there are plot holes that you could fly a warlock class destroyer through. The basic story idea, though, the basic concept of the story, especially some of the internal fightings within Psycor itself, I mean, it was a great premise. And there were actually some parts of the story that I really did enjoy. I kind of liked seeing Mr. Gray back, Harleman Gray. He was actually the one character that I thought was consistent. But, I mean, come on. Most of the story wouldn't have occurred. Can you see Bester not wanting to do at least a surface scan of everyone, of the teeps coming into the meeting? Or him caving the way he did at the end to Michael? I have a video of your people gambling with Londo. WTF? Sorry, I'll take Crusade over this one. That's my overall impression. So I'm going to shut my overactive mouth and pass it on to y'all.
Jim, you want to do yours? You want me to go?
No, I got it. I enjoyed the book. There were a few strange things, like the people in the desert, the Biligani, as I guess maybe there it said, but overall I was entertained and thought it was pretty well true to the franchise, for the most part, with a few new things thrown in there.
Yeah, I was, I felt kind of where you are with it, Jim. I liked it overall.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't great. Wasn't bad. I didn't think. To me, I would describe it as it felt comfortable. Felt like a B5 story, maybe a long one, as opposed to coming out of The Lost Tales, where we had two short ones. This one felt like a long B5 episode. It ended kind of quickly, which, you know, you mentioned, Raoul. But if for me, and I haven't read any of these novels before, for me, if this was something I read not because of the podcast, it wouldn't have turned me off. I would have wanted to read more of the novels. So it was a good gateway drug, I guess, or a good prompt for me to go, okay, this is good. I'll read more of these novels. So I was overall happy with it. I liked it. I liked it in the truest, most literal sense of the term. I liked it.
So I'm sort of the outlier here.
Well,
two out of three ain't bad.
It's neither here nor there. You know, you're going to like it or you're not going to like it. And, you know, it's not something that it's like, well, I think it's great and you need to think it's great too. No.
Yeah.
If it didn't strike a chord with you, well, it just didn't happen that way.
Character files opened.
So you want to take us through, Raoul, a brief discussion on the characters?
Sure. What I'm going to do is basically accurate portrayal and why or why not. I'm not going to declare it. I'm going to give my opinion. I want you guys to give yours as well, okay?
Yeah.
All right. And let's start off with what I would say is the main character of the story, Talia Winters. You know, one of her early lines in this is the crack that I'm a licensed commercial psychic, not an escort service. If you want to ask me for a date, I may not even charge you. Okay. Not only can I not see Talia saying this, but she said that to Kosh? Seriously? And a lot of her dialogue just doesn't improve from there, at least not in my opinion. Are you scanning me? No, she said, but I was comparing you to Commander St. Clair. I'm sorry. What the hell?
No, I took some of those kind of character deviations, anomalies or whatnot, as in this book, as I took that in the context of the book was being written as season one was happening, or maybe being written as season one was being written, parts of it. So
I can hope for that.
I can't say for sure, but I don't know if Vornholt knew enough about how the character would play out on the screen to know that what he was writing kind of slid into out of character for her.
Mm-hmm.
So I got past it because of that. Because, yeah, it was she was flippant with
But
Kosh.
We've had enough of her during the first season that we should have gotten an idea of how the character acts and reacts. Now, I will give some credit to your premise on, you know, like the ending. She went home to her parents. Oh, wait a second. That's not only not Talia. That's not Psycor. I mean, you know, for that, no. I can go with what you're saying, but beyond that,
wasn't it an uncle she finally?
Well, she went
up
home to her parents
with?
At the very end, and then it was her uncle who was the Marzi.
Yeah, I don't. I guess I didn't pick up on what you did, Raul. I was more during the body of the book that I kind of focused on her. And, you know, this showed her as a very formidable character, someone you don't mess with and someone who can take care of themselves when they need to. Okay. She's, you know, she's not some vulnerable fawn.
And that was good.
Yeah. That much.
Especially
was
when she used a little of her telekinesis from, Ironheart.
Yeah. And then, but as you say, going home to the parents, Psycor wouldn't allow that. She's probably never seen her parents.
Not since she was, you know, a very young child.
Yeah. So, yeah, there were a few plot holes there, but otherwise, you know.
Mm-hmm. Next character, Michael Garibaldi.
Hey.
I keep going back and forth on this. There were pieces where he fit, there were pieces where he didn't quite fit.
Oh, I agree.
I did like a little bit of him in Boston, particularly with it specifically being Boston, because what was it, a great aunt or something that was a Boston cop?
I think so.
His appreciation of Talia's assets, at least, is consistent.
Assets?
I actually got a chuckle from that. Though I think his, at points, it kind of goes into almost an infatuation that is kind of not what we would expect, having the other 4 years of development involved. But I can forgive that, at least. So I'll pass that on to y'all from here.
I could hear Garibaldi's voice
at times
in the character, even though you know there were oddities and they're kind of like Talia for me. So for all the main characters, and I just kind of wasn't that judgmental about them, because I in my head still it's like, well, this poor author was, like I mentioned, writing this as season one was being written, or writing this as season one was coming out. I don't know what he was exposed to, but he's probably trying, I assume, giving voice to Garibaldi as we're hearing, literally hearing and seeing the character unfold on the TV screen. So, but he felt like Mike Garibaldi to me overall.
Yeah, I agree for the most part. I was hoping for more snark.
Bingo. That was what was kind of missing.
I don't know if in the author's mind, of course, now, as you say, it was written during the first season, so we didn't get very much snark, because the author didn't realize we needed snark to be Garibaldi.
Well, considering when it took place, that's like, you know, that's an assumption we don't really know for sure yet. When was the decision to replace Sinclair with Sheridan made? When, during the off season, was this actually written?
There's a lot of unknowns.
Yeah, but then again, see, I was going to say that maybe the author saw Garibaldi as being more serious about this because someone he really, really cared about was in trouble, and we just never got to that.
Yep.
So I suppose we can move on to Harriman Gray. For those that don't remember who he is or wondering, yeah, he appeared in Eyes in the first season episode, number 16, and he was portrayed by Jeffrey Combs, Jeffrey Combs' only appearance on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a kind of mousy kind of guy. You know, he didn't create a lot of waves, but he took a liking to Susan Ivanova. And if you're a telepath, that's one person that probably is not going to reciprocate the feeling very well.
Okay. That character, I think he largely nailed. As JP likes to describe it, I heard that character's voice. The only thing that I had that kind of squirked me a little bit was, okay, he kind of borders into stalker territory. But then again, you know, how much did we know about him from the book itself? So,
right. Yep.
Yeah. As far as I was concerned, Gray got vastly expanded.
Yes.
In the book over what was in the show. He was interesting. And yes, I could hear Jeffrey Combs' voice. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at an autographed photo of Jeffrey Combs right now. And, you know, yeah, I could definitely hear Harriman Gray in there.
Mm-hmm. Deuce, who we've seen in a couple prior installments, Third Space and in Grail, with the fake Vorlon. Okay. That character was painful for me. The Deuce we saw in Babylon 5 would have simply shot Talia and been done with it. He wouldn't have considered, he wouldn't have hesitated. He wouldn't have spent a fourth of the book whining about how this was only going to cost him one diamond. The Deuce we had in this book didn't remind me of the Deuce from Babylon 5. Have either of you gentlemen seen Conan the Destroyer? The second Conan, you know, the second Schwarzenegger Conan movie?
No.
Long time
the
ago.
Kind of ratty comic thief that was his sidekick in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
That is who this Deuce reminded me of.
You know, what's telling about this character for me is he didn't remind me of Deuce from season one. I didn't remember. There was nothing in the character written in here that made me go, wait a second, I remember this guy. So maybe that's a failure in terms of the character in this case for me. But he served his purpose. It just didn't didn't remind me of the guy that you know from the series.
Yeah. See, I had to really reach to figure out who the hell Deuce was, you know. And then I looked it up and saw William Sanderson. Is like, oh, okay. Deuce doesn't stand out to me from the series. From in the episode Grail, he stands out more to me in Third Space as being one of the zombies that the obelisk or whatever it is takes over. But I was kind of open to that, and it seemed like, Raul, that yes, he was the kind of person who would have normally done what you say he did, and I think they even mentioned that in the book, and that he had thought that a couple of times, that, you know, I should have just shot you and been done with it. But he apparently needed her for something. So
what?
You know, not I don't know. that's just it. He seemed to be Talia's vehicle to get off the planet and to get to Earth and that kind of thing. Not a real dominant character.
Hmm.
Sorry, Deuce.
Yeah. Deuce, you didn't deuce it for us.
Next on our list, Mr. Bester, Alfred Bester.
Oh, Besters. I mean, yeah. He wasn't dominant in the novel, but you know, when he was there, yeah, he was Bester.
At times, he wasn't dominant, but his role was rather critical. How well was
it? Almost went to pieces.
Exactly, which is not Mr. Bester. When I saw the line,
No. I mean, he almost got blown to pieces.
Both ways.
He would have had the blues. Part of him blew this way, part of him blew that way.
Yeah.
You know, and actually it almost happened twice. The first instance, okay, I'll grant it, that was Bester. How would he handle a crisis? How would he handle emergency?
Yeah.
Calm, collected, to business, exactly what I would expect out of him. But then it kind of falls apart. The way he interacts with Gray at points, the lines where Bester is shrieking. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Alfred Bester never shrieks.
No, he does. Did you see it in the book? I agree with you. There were some oddities with
his
character.
Dear God, at the end. I don't believe you did it, but it's the kind of thing Ambassador Mallari would do. Get me a channel at headquarters. And all of a sudden, Talia's cleared. I guess I have to keep it family friendly. Bull, explicative, excrement.
Well, now, hold on a minute.
Bester's alone with Michael in a Psi-Corps vehicle with only Gray as a psychic defense. We saw what it took to block Bester. No. He's absolutely not going to just, oh, golly gee. Yeah, you got me. No.
Oh, well.
Anyway, you were going to say, Jim.
Yeah. I was going to say, we got to remember that Talia was programmed by Psi-Corps. And she has a specific purpose. And Bester knows this, so he's not going to want her damaged or compromised.
Yep. And you're also hitting some of my other... There is no way he's going to just trash Talia. She is too valuable of an asset. Not only because of the reprogram, you know, on two counts, the reprogramming, and he knows Ironheart did something with her, that something happened. So he's
now with with Bester in here. There was something, I think, if I caught it right, it kind of confused me. Okay. Did it mention that Lauren had problems or died or something?
I don't know.
I don't remember.
The young apprentice psych cop that was in training, I thought it said something. He said something early in the book. Something happened to her or another character that he had interacted with. And it was like, it seemed to me like it was Lauren, which she came along way later.
Oh. Was she later, or was she the psychop that was with him during the Ironheart incident?
Okay. No, Lauren was the young woman that liked him. But at any rate, did you have your say with Bester, JP?
The only thing that stood out odd for me about him was the exchange he had with Jakar after the big bar fight.
Mm.
He seemed very kind to Jakar. And I didn't know if that was a weakness in how the character was written, or if there was something else coming and Bester was schmoozing, essentially setting up something else. And then I don't remember... that I got an answer. So I in other words, the something else never seemed to show up, or I didn't connect the dots. So I think that was just another example of a character that didn't quite appear in the pages the way that we know he was in the series.
Yep.
But it was, to me, it was like he was excessively and almost genuinely kind to Jakar. And it just struck me as a little bit odd. My reaction was, where is this leading? And it didn't go anywhere. So. I didn't mind him. I didn't mind Bester.
One thing that did stand out, and it wasn't by anything he said, it was by what he didn't do. After the first event on Mars, in moving things to Babylon 5, especially once there was some sort of credible threat, he left it for Garibaldi to address security for the telepaths coming into and out of the event, right? Did that not strike you as at least the least bit odd? All it would have taken for the entire story to completely be pointless was a simple scan. Are you planning any sort of mischief or for the event? You wouldn't have been.
Doesn't that fall into it's in the script kind of a thing though? That would have taken a lot of story out.
Completely kills the thing, and then the whole manhunt for Talia. She's been deep scanned before with Ironheart. It isn't fun. Mm-hmm. It's not the horror mind melt that she. The entire story gets cleared up there with a deep scan.
Yeah.
Done. And that is exactly, both of those are exactly what, for Bester not to do those, is completely out of character for him.
Yeah.
All right. I know we're definitely have to move it along here.
Move on.
Captain Sheridan next.
Yeah, he didn't impress me at all. As a matter of fact, until I looked at my notes again, I didn't even remember he was in the book.
Yeah,
which the whole idea about him being snappish. Now, in this case, I'll cut a little bit of slack here on it. This is very much the character is so brand new to the story that the author probably didn't have a whole lot to go on it yet.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, because at the beginning, Sheridan was very friendly, really nice guy. Yeah, and he hardened as time went on.
Yep. I think his opinion of Sycor was a little too friendly. I mean, heck, the single most pro-Sycor of Earth Force that we saw was Lockley in season 5, and she wasn't even that friendly, as friendly as Bester or as Sheridan was. But again, I'll excuse it because the character is so brand spanking new to the series, as you know, to the franchise. JP, your thoughts?
Yeah,
I've kind of like you said, Jim. I forgot by the end of the book, I had forgotten Sheridan was even in the book. But it didn't bug me because I didn't feel like he was, frankly, all that important to the story. He was almost stage dressing in a weird way.
Good point.
There was a description about him that I was looking through my notes real quick that kind of humored me, and I can't find it at the moment. But if I come across it and it's worth jumping in later, I'll bring it up then. But yeah, I moved past him in my mind and was focused on primarily Talia, Garibaldi, Gray and Deuce and those cats that we've already talked about who are really at the core of the novel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think we could probably say the same about Kosh, Londo and Lanier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're there and it's cool that they're there because they were there in the series. But...
And the Toth.
Yeah. But we do have this Arthur Maltin.
Yeah.
Okay. This is now
and Emily Crane.
Maltin in particular now is really the second character that I actually liked. It's the one character where with the interaction, for the most part at least, Bester in the book was the most Bester that we would expect. One of the positives that kind of stood out for me was the nothing personal. It was just business kind of interaction that they had. I don't know. I want to call them frenemies, but I mean, it was basically a coup he was planning, though, to be honest, one of the things we learn as we go in through the series that Bester really isn't the most powerful man in Psycor. In fact, far from it. He just happens to be an important psychop. So anyway, other thoughts on Malton?
I took him at face value because I didn't know who he would be otherwise. So I liked him like you did, Raoul. I liked the character. It didn't get in the way of the story. He added to the story.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Emily Crane, though, you know, was his supposed associate, turns out to be a scary woman.
Yeah, I did not like the, I mean, I think she could have been better written, but I didn't, there was nothing that particularly impressed me on the one hand, but the flip side, there wasn't anything that I found particularly disliking about her. She was a plot device.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the way, you know, she's playing all sides against the middle. And, you know, a catalyst to bring all of this together. And that's kind of what I liked when I found it, you know, when she handed off the bomb to,
Talia,
who brought it into the, unwittingly brought it into the conference room. I thought that was kind of cool. Although it was predictable because before the conference started, when those two met and she handed the data crystal to Talia, I said, oh, here we go. Yep. This is the bomb.
Yep, it was pretty predictable.
Jerry bomb. Hello, Dad. Hello, Mom. Cherry bomb. I know, I'm not Joan Jett, but then who is? All right, and then the one other real important character we got here is Ivanova, which, you know, with her in the middle of a Psycor convention on the station would make me think of her being like a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs.
Yeah,
just awkward.
Yeah, this just ain't working, you know what I mean?
You know.
But you know, the way I think the main thing for her on the station was, or on, in the novel was to deal with Gray.
She was almost the comic
for
relief.
One thing. Well, and Ivanova became who Gray wanted to impress. That he wasn't like the others, that he was different and he was honorable and he genuinely liked her. And that was Ivanova was his ideal.
In a creepy stalker sort of way.
Yeah, not really. No. So bad. I mean, he wasn't stalking. He was coming out.
Yeah, that's true. He wasn't hiding in the shadows. He was right up front. I was like, oh, goody. Ivanova's here.
Yeah. But he held up Ivanova as the grail that he was on his quest for. And, you know, I kind of felt bad for him on that. And I thought Ivanova actually did a really nice job of trying to let him down. she wasn't cruel.
Yeah.
She kind of started out that way, but then I think she figured out that Gray was being genuine.
I was initially annoyed with the initial presentation of Ivanova here. The whole bit with Garibaldi about being snitty as far as rank is concerned, which was a little out, but everything you said, you know, it's like once we got past that, everything you said was, nailed it. And we've pretty much covered the other characters already that were just appearance.
Yeah, how about JP? What'd you think of Ivanova?
Oh, I don't have anything to add. She, to me, was kind of like Sheridan playing a bigger role. She's a primary secondary character. How about that? But the story for me moved along with her as an enabler of it. So I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about her character. Again, like I said before about others, not a distraction. She was fine for me, mm-hmm. and I just moved on watching the bigger story unfold.
Yep.
Yeah. About the only thing that I think, as far as organizations are concerned, I think Free Phobos was
an interesting twist on the was an interesting bit, yeah.
But it actually didn't exist,
right?
So, but they sure had a presence. You know, Emily Crane mm-hmm. seemed to be Free Phobos, and the mix, and playing the Senate and the Psycor and everybody against everybody else.
Well, one thing that kind of threw me off in the organizations was the mix itself. They were a part of the Psycor. And this is one thing that Vornhall didn't seem to get. Psycor and the Psycops, I mean, the Psycops are just one piece of the Psycor. Just mm-hmm. like the mix was a subset, you know, it was a group that was a part of Psycor. The standard commercial TEEP operation mm-hmm. was another part of Psych. You know, there might have been some internal conflict there, yeah, but it's like it was part of the same group. And go ahead with what you were gonna add about groups in the story. I think I know where you're gonna go.
Now, the Biligani, I guess that's how you say it. Biligani, mm-hmm. the Native Americans that weren't Native Americans that wanted to live primitive, but they cheated and had tricks and things to work with. This group to me seemed like a deus ex machina.
Yes.
For getting Talia away from Deuce and on the road to Boston.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's not to say they weren't kind of interesting, and there were a couple of interesting characters involved in that.
And certainly just the whole idea of that kind of romanticization of a different culture or a different lifestyle or a different way of life is, I mean, we see things like that today.
Yeah. It was an interesting spot in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So, JP, what do you think?
About those guys?
Yeah.
I thought there was too much development of that group, that organization, whatever you want to call them, to serve the purpose that they served in the story. So I didn't know if there was more. It's another one of those like, I wonder in a future book. So I think this guy wrote one other book, right? John
Vornhold.
I think he wrote one other of the books. And he spent enough time developing a group of people that could ultimately just facilitate the movement of a main character that I felt like there would have to be more about them later. I suspect we won't know anything else about them.
We won't.
So exercise in volume to hit the required length for the novel. It wasn't bad. It just seemed like...
What was the point?
It seemed like too much. Yeah, it was too much. She could have hit among probably any number of other organizations or entities or peoples, I suspect. But it was a cool little development of an odd culture. Mm-hmm. But I don't know really how it added to the story.
On the plus side, it really didn't take anything away, though.
No, it didn't. It didn't.
Okay. So, Jim.
Yeah. All right. I was typing into the notes. So, you know, is there anything we covered a lot of the story already by talking about the characters and things. Is there anything in the story that we did not cover that anyone would like to bring up?
My big thing actually is probably those two big plot holes where the story literally would not happen, but I've already discussed that ad nauseum with much arm flapping in the air.
Nothing else from me either, other than the few points where I said I felt like we have including the Biligani, where I felt like there would have to be more coming later. And it just didn't happen. But that's okay.
You know, I wonder when I see something like that or someone mentions something like that, I wonder if it wasn't maybe it was longer than they wanted, than the publisher wanted, and sent it back and said, cut stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, yeah, I had thought he added that stuff to get it to a correct length, but in fact, there may have been a lot more that got cut out.
That happens.
Yeah, because as you said, there was a lot of development with that group, a lot of explanation of what they were and what they were doing and how they were living, a whole lot more than, as you say, was worth in the story, so... Could have been, hey, cut stuff. This is too long. This is longer than we want. And that would have been, in my mind at least, that seemed like a logical place to cut story out.
You know, and it could have actually been something that Straczynski had in his mind somewhere as far as, you know, people from this group or this culture almost, I mean, you're looking at a real good basis for Earth First here. Or a subculture that he could have brought to the station but never got around to because the story took different directions.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we hit the mm-hmm. story broadly pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, JP, you like to...
So...
Go ahead, Jim. Sorry.
I was just going to say, so where do we go next?
One of the things that JP has brought into a lot of the... to a lot of our discussions with some of the more in-depth thoughts on themes. So let's get some thoughts here, JP.
Yeah. So maybe what I'll do is throw these out there. There's not that many. And then we'll just discuss the ones that resonate with you guys, or obviously you could throw in other mm-hmm. ones. The themes that, you know, if we're using sci-fi as social commentary or things like that, the themes that stood out that could be communicating something bigger than just the surface story. Clearly there's a terrorism theme in here. There's politics in general, but then I felt like there was setup or mutual support for what we see develop in the original series later about the large corporate influence on politics. And their attempts or successes in controlling politics. There's a running from the law theme here, particularly with Talia, and a little bit of how she manages that hopelessness surfaces as a theme.
Mm-hmm.
Big one that we've batted about already is telepaths. And groundwork, I'll say it's groundwork, because we see so much more of this later in the series and then in a subsequent novel trilogy, is the power of telepaths, the identity struggle between commercial telepaths and the government, so the mix and the Psi-Corps. In the novel, the way Psi-Corps is described, the emerging or developing role and purpose of Psi-Corps, it was as if they were a relatively new or organization or one that was growing significantly and finding its way. And so maybe a stage setter ultimately for the Psi-Corps trilogy, even though that trilogy was not written by this guy. But if Straczynski had given outlines for these novels or had them in his possession, this could have been a deliberate setup for that trilogy.
Hmm.
The last one being... not a surprise at all, but it's in there as an atmospheric, that might not be the best word, is that B5, it establishes along with the first season to show that B5 is a neutral and somewhat independent entity inside of the larger galactic, you know, the larger interaction between Earth and all of the other races or peoples or worlds. It becomes the perfect place to have an awful act happen, mm-hmm. like the explosion that went down.
Mm-hmm.
Because they really are not a political thing. They're politics in the Earth sense. They're a diplomatic, you know, a last best hope and all of that. So those were the themes that that stood out to me, the terrorism and politics, running from the law, the big one of the telepaths and what their struggles are, and then B5.
Yeah. I like, you know, the politic theme is kind of interesting here, where you have a company vying to take over a government organization.
But that company was part of that government organization, though.
Yeah, but they're looking to gain more control over it, and they are not interested in the PsyCops.
Nope.
Because the PsyCops are not making any money. The commercial telepaths are bringing in the income.
This is the subordinate division of a big entity that wants to become the dominant player, the owner. They want to be the big entity.
And that actually was one of my favorite plot points of the book, to be perfectly honest.
So what would happen to PsyCops if the mix took over and, you know, well, sorry guys, we don't need you anymore. You can become commercial telepaths, but there's no more PsyCops. That's it.
They'd go over to the military side.
Would the military want them? Or would we have had the PsyCops Civil War long before Byron ever started his movement?
I'd call it 50-50. At least based on just the thought of this book. This book really doesn't have much to do with the PsyCore trilogy, you'll find.
Because I'll tell you what, there is no way anywhere that I can see Bester setting down his PPG and saying, okay, yeah, I'll be a commercial telepath.
No chance in hell.
Yeah.
I don't think that would happen.
And he's not going to just be a grunt in the military arm either.
Oh,
so maybe this was a hook for a possible, you know, a whole nother storyline that is about a Teep Civil War or something like you said, Jim, like Byron was trying to facilitate.
Except this is supposed to be a standalone story in the universe.
Right.
Yeah, because and a standalone story, I think, is one of those where that when you get to the end, everything is the way it was in the beginning.
Beginning.
You know, you get to the end of the book and the last chapter, you press the reset button and everything is the way it was and the way it was supposed to be. That way you don't have to worry about the TV show answering to what happens in the novels.
Yeah. Yep. And I think that happened here. You know, the what if, these what ifs we're doing with the Teeps is stayed a what if, because in the end, I felt like we were, with this particular problem set or this theme, we were kind of where we started. Mm. We just got to see some of the ugliness under the surface that you might not see if you weren't in the know about PsyCore and PsyCops and then the relationship to the mix. Outside looking in, it looks like it's all hunky-dory.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of reset that you're talking about, Jim, which kind of happens in chapters 19 and 20. Bear in mind, season 2 was well underway when this book came out originally, and for a lot of us, it was, you know, somewhere midway through season 2 that we finally, it's like, oh, that book's here, let's read it. And that is probably where a lot of my antagonism goes, because the kind of reset that we see here fit in the series in much the same way that Third Space did for you guys. It becomes a real WTF moment for us, or for many of us.
Yeah. So, you know, running from the law and hopelessness, JP, you have hopelessness in there. What? I don't know if I've detected Talia ever becoming hopeless.
There was a few points where she was, you know, it's like, okay, I'm ready to just give it in. Or would it be easier just to give it in? But then her inner resolve kicked
maybe
in.
Maybe desperation then, or
That's a good
hopeless
word.
May not be a good descriptor. Desperation
might be better.
Desperate, but she maintained hope. She continued to be hopeful that she would be successful, but there were a few times in there where it looked like she had gotten backed into a corner she wasn't going to get out mm-hmm. of.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. And those were the moments that I was thinking of, or that come to mind in that regard is, that as powerful as she is, this person who's engineered, programmed or whatever you want to call it by Psycor, they were able to box her in.
No, she was only a
P5. It looked desperate.
Yeah.
Which is actually average. That was one of the things that annoyed me. And I just fell victim to it myself. I said only a P5. P5 is your average telepath.
Right.
Not
your average commercial grade telepath.
Yeah. She was not particularly, even without Ironheart, she was not particularly weak. Sometimes the book kind of gave, but I think desperation, your phrase desperation probably does fit a little better.
Does better.
Mm-hmm.
I could feel for her, when she got desperate or when she got, boxed in. I thought the author did a good job there of making me see that she knew she was in trouble. It wasn't, I'll get out of this. I'll figure it mm-hmm. out.
Yeah.
She did, sometimes with help, but that part was pretty good. But the running from the law, really the bigger theme is, being a fugitive, running from the law. And there's some other stuff related to that how people get framed I have at least one comment that will come up later that relates to that. Actually, if we transition into talking about plot, favorite plot points. I'm going to come back to this, how Bester handled Talia on the run.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a favorite plot point. It wasn't, I'm not going to complain about it, but it was an interesting issue, I guess, that may track back to some of the ways characters were written.
Yeah.
Anything
else on themes?
No, actually, and JP just gave us a great segue to some of our favorite plot points. And looks like both of you said, the basic plot around the internal coup within the Psycor is great. That definitely had the feel of, okay, that idea, the clip that you played kind of goes along with that. Had to come from JP. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
That had to come from JMS. I don't think JP was consulting for Straczynski back then.
No, I can assure you I was not.
The idea, and I mentioned this already, is, the whole it's just business, nothing personal. I've actually encountered, not with quite such lethal outcomes, but I've actually encountered that in some of my work within the business world and within some of the things that I've been involved with, in that clinical research versus business side of things. So that part, of the basic plot, in spite of all the other gripes that I've had, really did it for me. I really like that. Just that struggle within was good. So JP, your thoughts?
Related, and I set this up in my comments just a second ago, but the struggle between Psycor and the mix, I really like that part of the story, and related to it, Bester's, whatever his real ability to wield power inside the core or as a psychop, the ugliness of Bester that we all know and love or love to hate comes out when he acknowledges that Talia is innocent, but rather than admitting what he characterized as a mistake or he worried would be perceived as a mistake, He'd rather commit crimes to cover that up than just to come up with maybe a more creative, it's almost like he doesn't have the time to make it right creatively. He's just gonna cover it up with crime. You know, he could have spun a story that I don't think she would have had the ability to easily refute, like, oh, she was really working for us all along. You know, she was a plant. She may not have even known that she was a pawn, but we knew that there was this problem, and we used Talia to expose.
See, I could have bought that a lot easier than what they actually ended up doing.
But when they didn't do it that way, to me, it made Bester look really ugly. In a way that I think he is really ugly.
He is that ugly, but how they did that was just out of character.
Yeah, so, and we talked about that. You know, I cut some characters slack across the board in the novel because of where it fell in the, relative to the series, but that could definitely either be a criticism of the writing or of good writing, but just a flaw in the character as written. But the real thing that was a favorite plot point for me was that struggle between Psycor and the Mix. I thought that was, you know, it's like watching a mob movie or a show like The Sopranos or something where, you know, you start out thinking you know something. Dune, by the way, the Bene Gesserit in Dune would be another example where you're shown something early in the telling of the series of novels, in the case of Dune, and you view the Bene Gesserit as this monolithic, very clean, well-organized entity that you learn over time has got all the same problems and divisions and struggles that exist everywhere else. And looking at Psycor and how the Mix and Psycor Main or what are just duking it out, and then you got Bester in the middle of it, as you know, as we know, is a bad man. But I enjoyed that about the novel a lot, that struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite plot point. How about you, Jim?
Yeah, I kind of thought along the same lines, except I was speculating. My favorite thing to do with this part of it, the Mix and the Psycor, was to speculate on what they would look like, what it would look like to have the Psycops out, where they would go, what they would do, and how would it affect the future going forward? Would Santiago have been assassinated? Would Clark have taken over? Any of the Earth problems, would they have happened had the Mix been successful in their takeover? So it was just kind of, it just raised some questions for me.
Probably, I would guess probably just because of the shadows and the shadow influence, but it might have taken a very different form.
It might have looked different. What if the Drak had put keepers on Santiago or something, you know? Anyway, another thing I really enjoyed about this story was how Garibaldi never gave up on Talia, and he remained steadfast and was going to help her as best he could, whether she wanted his help or not. And she obviously didn't,
and that is
she took it on the lamb. But Garibaldi's kind of like one of those Gila monsters that, you know, they bite and they don't let go. There's, you know, and the same thing with Gray. I kind of enjoyed how he just never gave up on Susan. He never lost hope that he was going to win her over somehow. And after all, can you blame him?
Nope.
And
you
she
know
would
what,
be
Jim?
Quite
you're,
a prize.
You're just a hopeless romantic.
I guess.
A closet Hallmark junkie.
Wrong. Wrong. You call me a Hallmark junkie again, and I'm going to climb through this microphone and show you something. Anyway.
Some romantic.
I'll admit I've watched my an undue share of rom-coms, so
No, I'll tell you what. So have I, but they've normally been decent movies. Not like Kill Bill. Not on Hallmark. You know, Hallmark has like six actors on staff, and those six actors are in every freaking movie they make.
It just seems like that sometimes, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. All right. So anyway, well, let's move on, and we need to get this wrapped up. Yeah. How about we go into favorite quotes? Raul, why don't you start us off with, your favorite quotes?
Only one. And
okay.
Bester's line, "That's anatomically impossible," he said, but a popular sentiment. That was one of the few times I truly heard Walter Koenig's voice when I was reading it. And he made that comment to Talia. It was, for me, that particular note was almost a book saver. And it was fortunately reasonably early into the book. But
yeah.
I loved it. The circumstance is a circumstance. He was impersonating Maltin telepathically. It was something Bester would do, and it was said exactly the way Bester would say it.
Yeah. So, JP, you have several quotes you pulled out of here.
I had five. I'm going to make it three. I'm dropping one of those because I feel like it. The other one I'm going to drop is because it's a piece of a quote that I think is probably one of your favorites.
And the fact that we're kicking into an hour and a half.
So here are the ones that will make my favorite quote list. The first one is a Bester quote, where he says, "If you find something of value here on Mars, it may be priceless." And I thought that a little snark out of Bester there. Next one, this is Talia talking. "We have a certain destiny to fill," talking about telepaths, "and we will need to be upfront about it." And then Sheridan responds, "I would suggest you remember one thing, Ms. Winters. When you're up front, they shoot at you first."
I did like that line.
Good one. Good one.
That was a good one.
And then the last one is Arthur Maltin saying, "That's why I'm against giving so much power to a class of telepaths who have nothing going for them except that they're P-12s and P-11s. Being a P-12 doesn't mean you're well-adjusted, have common sense, or good communication skills. In most cases, it means you're as neurotic as hell."
That was a decent line.
Man, Arthur, not pulling out any punches.
No.
I'll offer those as my favorite quotes.
Okay. My favorite quote, I'll tell you what, if JMS did not write this and say, use this in the book, I would be very surprised, because this is perfect. Perfect. It would have been a great, great deal on the show. Anyway, you got Harriman and Garibaldi. They're in a shuttle together. And, Harriman says, and he says, "You saw her? You made positive identification?" "Well," admitted Garibaldi, "all I saw was her rear end, but that's enough." Gray wrinkled his nose. "Really, Garibaldi? That's disgusting. You see a woman's rear end and you fantasize that you can identify Miss Winters just from her rear end? I hadn't realized you were such close associates." "Trust me," claimed Garibaldi, "I've been watching that can very closely for the past year, and I know it by heart." You know.
Yep.
Which is a reference back to Garibaldi every time he's in the elevator with Talia.
Yep.
He's.
Yeah. His eyes travel there more than once, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. So, how about JP? Take us through our closing thoughts.
So, we've kind of talked through the whole thing here. I'll give you guys a shot at any closing thoughts before I wrap it up. Want to lead off there, Raul?
there were some high points, but I'm glad I'll never have to reread this book. I'm glad I won't have to read it again.
That's fair.
Jim's quote did cause me to raise my rating a bit, but I'll get to that. I'll get to that at a later point. It felt like someone trying to imitate Babylon 5 than actually being Babylon 5. And I'm sorry, I loved our discussion. There were a few high points of the book, but nothing to really change my thoughts. And actually, while I'm rapidly flipping through my Kindle during the conversation, there's just point after point after point along those lines that it, where I comment out that it just didn't feel right. That I'm glad the book was over.
How about you, Jim?
Well, as I said before, I enjoyed it. I thought it was an entertaining story. It moved pretty rapidly. There were some great things and great times in this book, and there were some other places where, I could have done without. But overall, I thought it was a good book. I enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to the next one.
All right. And then for me, it ends, I'm going to end it the way I began it, which is that it felt comfortable for me as a first novel. It was a nice walk through parts of the B5 universe, gave some backstory, gave a few more insights into some of our familiar characters, even if some of them were out of character. And I think it was a good stage setter, whether there's direct story connections or not, it was a good stage setter for me for the other novels. Got one additional closing thought from our producer, who pointed out that toward the end of the book, they talk about a bar, and in the bar, people are playing ping pong and billiards, and this is on Mars. Troy's observation was that he's not sure how playing ping pong in 30% of Earth's gravity would really work.
Didn't they talk about the World Series in Mars once?
Oh, I can't remember. But so the closing thoughts. Raul, what about ratings? You mentioned that you would change your rating a little bit after Jim's quote.
Yep. Just because of Talia's can, my rating goes up to a one. My rating goes up to
just can't help myself.
It goes up to a 1.25 on the 1 to 5 scale.
You're only giving her 0.25.
Oh my god, poor Talia.
Yeah, you know, Troy. I was just gonna say, Troy will tell Andrea about this.
No. Oh, Andrea. Oh, hey, that says a whole lot of how much I dislike the book compared to how much I did like her can.
Oh, I see. We're getting in deeper and deeper.
Yeah, we just all keep right. Digging here.
Oh boy,
I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5.
Okay. Any elaboration on that, or just you're going to just leave it lay there?
No, I think I caught it in the closing thoughts. It was a good, decent beginning novel for me.
Oh, okay.
Wasn't great. Wasn't awful. It was, I was okay with it. I give it a 3 out of 5.
Okay. I'm going with a 3.5, rating on this book, 3.5, booms.
There you go.
3 point. Yeah, this is our boom scale, a 1 through 5 boom scale. And I'm going to give it a 3.5 booms out of 5. Just because I thought it was a good, solid book. I enjoyed it a lot. It wasn't the best thing I have ever read, but I thought it fit the universe very well. So, and that's it.
Well, Jim.
Before you do that, Raul, talk about you want to give the rating. You want to talk about the rating they give on Goodreads?
Well, there's not much I can say about it except that it got a 3.31. Okay. And our overall average worked out, thanks to Talia, to being a 2.6.
Yeah.
So it seems that there were a lot of people who did like the book marginally better than I did.
Okay. So
that said, Jim.
Next time.
Yes, that.
Next time you hear us, we're going to be talking about Accusations by Lois Tilton. This would be the second book out of the standalone novels, and so that's kind of where we'll be going from there. And that begs just one last question.
It does.
Did we have any? Yeah, did we have any boom?
Well, do bombs going off on Mars and on the station count as boom?
I would say they do.
Oh, then we definitely had some boom today.
We had boom today.
Does Talia's can count as an extra
that
boom?
Counts,
boom, that counts. Chuck, boom, chuck. Boom, chuck.
Okay, Jim, you can, regardless. You can ding yourself on that one.
Okay, I'm dinged.
Yep.
All right.
Well, I guess that also answers the boom tomorrow question too, doesn't it?
I guess. Are we going to have boom tomorrow?
Of course.
JP, why are we going to have boom tomorrow?
Because there's always boom tomorrow.
I thought you were going to say because Talia's in the next book too, but...
I don't know. I haven't read it yet.
Neither have I. All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night, all. Jim?
Oh, say good night, JP.
Good night, JP.
So long.
Have a good one.
Podcast terminated.
Thank you for listening to the Babylon Project podcast. You can email Raul and Jim at thebabylonprojectpodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook at the Babylon Project Podcast. On the internet, we are at babylonprojectpodcast.wordpress.com. To subscribe to the podcast, you can find us on iTunes, or you can subscribe to the RSS feed on the webpage.